From NPR and WBUR, I'm Tanya Mosley.
I'm Peter O'Dowd. This is Here and Now. Tension today in Minneapolis and around the country as a dozen jurors deliberate the charges against Derek Chauvin, the former Minneapolis police officer charged with killing George Floyd. Public officials and community leaders have been asking for calm once the jury reaches its verdict. It could come at any time, in a matter of hours or even days. And as we wait, there's still a lot to discuss from a legal perspective. So let's bring in Georgetown University law professor Tiffany Jeffers to work through some of the complexity of the trial and these deliberations. Professor Jeffers, welcome.
Thank you, Peter. Thanks so much for having me.
Well, we're glad to have you. And why don't we start with the three charges that the jury is deliberating right now as we speak: second degree manslaughter, and then second and third degree murder. What kind of distinction will the jury be making here in these different charges?
So the most serious charge here is, of course, the second degree murder. And I think what's important for listeners to remember is that for none of these charges is it required that the prosecution prove that former Officer Chauvin intended to kill George Floyd, right? So the intent issue came up in closing arguments on both sides. And the intent doesn't have to be to kill, as the prosecution argued. The intent needs to be related to the action, which was Chauvin's knee on Floyd's neck. And so the distinction between the two is really the seriousness of the penalty and what needs to be proved. But for none of them do the prosecution attorneys need to prove intent to kill.
Hey, can you explain why that is so significant?
It's significant because if we think about intent to kill, it's tough to get into a person's state of mind and know what their intention for the outcome was without some type of additional evidentiary support. Maybe they wrote it down or something like that. But in this instance, just knowing in the moment what Chauvin's state of mind was, it's almost impossible to place an intent on what he thought the outcome would be. But placing intent on what a person's actually doing is a much more reasonable legal standard to satisfy.
I see. Well, in the closing arguments yesterday, the prosecution urged the jurors to trust their eyes, referring to, of course, the infamous video of Chauvin with his knee on Floyd's neck. The attorney said, "What you saw, you saw. You know how George Floyd died." And I just wonder, if there is a conviction, how important do you think that video will be in handing it down?
That video is critical to the conviction. It's not the only piece of evidence. Every person that testified, their testimony is considered evidence. The two autopsy reports are considered evidence. The toxicology report is evidence. However, the video is critical because we're seeing in real time the last moments of George Floyd's life, and we're seeing Derek Chauvin's reaction to the crowd. We're seeing his reaction to Floyd's request for help and relief. And without that video, painting the picture simply from testimony would be less effective than jurors watching it in real time with their own eyes, as the prosecution has indicated.
So then what do you make of the defense's closing arguments yesterday and what Chauvin's team needed to accomplish before sending that case off to the jury?
I don't think the defense I think they did a good job with what they had. However, it's just a difficult uphill battle for the defense in this instance, again, because of this video that the world has watched. Trying to mischaracterize the proof needed to satisfy these charges is ineffective, in my opinion. And pointing to other types of potential causes of death, the exhaust fumes, and you know, it's completely unreasonable to expect jurors who have watched a video and watched this happen in real time to then latch on to some other legal theory for the reason of George Floyd's death.
Okay. I want to get your take on a potential wrench that was thrown into this case. There was some controversy yesterday when the defense asked for a mistrial because Congresswoman Maxine Waters had told reporters in Minnesota that if Chauvin was not found guilty, if there was no conviction, that protesters would have to get more active and more confrontational. Here's what the judge, Peter Cahill, said about that.
Well, I'll give you that Congresswoman Waters may have given you something on appeal that may result in this whole trial being overturned, but what's the state's position?
So from a legal standpoint, did Congresswoman Waters jeopardize this trial? What do you think?
Absolutely not. Congresswoman Waters did not jeopardize this trial. And I think it's disingenuous of Judge Cahill to reprimand her in that way from the bench. specifically because it'd be really difficult for the defense to link any one juror's verdict directly to Congresswoman Waters' tweet or her statements. And without that link, without that direct link, that tweet itself or her statements themselves would not be sole grounds for an appeal in this instance. And so I think that frustration that Judge Cahill exhibited from the bench yesterday was misplaced.
All right. I have just 20 seconds here. Do you have any sense of when this verdict might come down from your experience?
As a former prosecutor, deliberate long, deliberate wrong. That's what we used to say.
All right. Georgetown Law Professor Tiffany Jeffers, thank you very much for your insights.
Thank you.
It's been nearly a decade since Colorado became one of the first states to legalize cannabis for recreational use, and it's still pretty much an indoor crop. A new study confirms that growing marijuana in closed warehouses has a massive carbon footprint. But researchers also found some unexpected ways growers could help reduce that impact. Colorado Public Radio's Sam Brash reports.
According to Chris Baca, cannabis cultivation is really about tricking plants.
Growing is all about your environmentals. We're trying to mimic a lot of things that happen outdoors, but in an indoor setting.
Baca grows cannabis for The Clinic, a Denver-based marijuana dispensary. Like most other growers in the city, he works in a windowless warehouse. The hum you're hearing is everything it takes to hoodwink his plants into behaving like they're outdoors.
We start off with the lights. It's obviously very bright in here. With those lights, you're also going to get a rise in temperature. So we have a significant amount of AC that goes into these growing rooms.
Meanwhile, fans draw in fresh air, pumps feed water and nutrients to roots. Baca says there's no way around it. In its current form, growing pot indoors uses a ton of energy.
Cannabis does, take a lot to create it. It takes a lot of carbon footprint, But at the same time, it's like I see it as a kind of a good thing to let people know how bad it kind of really is.
A new study from Colorado State University breaks down that process and adds up each component's greenhouse gas emissions. Graduate student Haley Summers led the research published in Nature Sustainability. She says it takes the widest possible view of growing marijuana indoors.
So a really quick example of what that means is if we're using fertilizers in a grow house, we accounted for emissions for actually producing those fertilizers.
In her final assessment, indoor marijuana cultivation now accounts for nearly 1.5% of Colorado's greenhouse gas emissions. To put that in perspective, that's about the same climate impact as the state's coal mining industry.
When I compared it to some entire other sectors like coal mining, that's really when it really sank in for me.
Summers' study also found more than 80% of those emissions can be chalked up to things that only happen with indoor grows. Think high-powered lights, heating, air conditioning. Most or all of that could be eliminated in outdoor or greenhouse facilities. For Summers, that all raises a basic question.
Why are we growing plants indoors?
From her research, Summers believes it has a lot to do with Colorado's early legalization policies, which tried to keep cannabis out of public view. The idea was that growing pot in nondescript warehouses would make the process more secure and easier to regulate. Ben Gelt runs the Cannabis Certification Council, which promotes sustainable practices in the industry. He says that's part of the story, but not all of it.
I certainly wouldn't disagree with the position that early regulation slanted the table towards indoor production, but that's a really such a small part of the puzzle.
A bigger point, according to Gelt, customers. Sun-grown cannabis can use less energy, but it's not going to make the best product for a pipe, a joint, or a social media post.
Outdoor product tends to have a harder shell. It doesn't tend to have the same sticky feel that you get a lot of times that you see on Instagram and stuff.
Gelt says that's why cannabis grown outdoors largely goes towards edibles or vape pens, products where you don't see the plant itself. Warehouses also let growers work year-round in carefully controlled climate conditions. From an environmental perspective, Gelt says it'd be great if more growers moved outdoors or into greenhouses.
But to just say, we need to snap our fingers and do it, it's not realistic.
So he says indoor operations have to get more efficient. One example can be seen at the Clinic warehouse. Like most of the industry, Baca pipes carbon dioxide into his grow rooms to supercharge plant growth.
And so within a week, they get about a foot taller.
They grow a foot in a week.
Yeah.
Usually, cannabis growers use CO2 captured at fertilizer plants, which is then bottled up into heavy canisters and shipped hundreds of miles. The clinic has mostly eliminated those emissions through a partnership with the Denver Beer Company. The brewery supplies the warehouse with its excess CO2, and it's just a few miles down the road.
If I were to open this valve, the CO2 actually smells like beer.
After lights and climate control, the Colorado State University study found that bottling and shipping carbon dioxide is the third largest emission source for indoor grows. So projects to recycle the gas from local sources, that might actually make cannabis just a little bit greener. For Here and Now, I'm Sam Brash in Denver.
Joe Arpaio liked to call himself America's toughest sheriff, and for more than two decades, his many supporters cheered on the Maricopa County Sheriff's hardline approach to immigration in the state of Arizona. Arpaio carried out workplace raids, conducted sweeps in Latino neighborhoods. U.S. citizens said they were being racially profiled, and a federal judge agreed. But even as Arpaio's legal troubles mounted, his tactics didn't stop. He even set the stage for Donald Trump, whose stance on immigration helped carry him to the White House. A new book charts the rise and fall of one of the most controversial sheriffs in modern memory. It's called Driving While Brown, Sheriff Arpaio versus the Latino Resistance. Journalist Jude Joffe Block co-wrote the book, and she joins us now. Jude, welcome. It's great to speak with you.
Great to speak with you, Peter.
So Arpaio is no doubt, you know, very famous, but a lot of people only heard about him once he was well into his 60s and 70s. What can you tell us about his early years and how they kind of turned him into the guy who would eventually become known as America's toughest sheriff?
Yeah, it's interesting because most people can't name their own sheriff, let alone somebody else's sheriff in another county. Yet Joe Arpaio was nationally known within a few years of his tenure. He was elected in 1992. He was there for 24 years. And the first half of his tenure, he was famous for making his inmates wear pink underwear, making his inmates sleep in outdoor tents and eat unpleasant food. Those kinds of antics really made his brand, and he was really a master at getting media attention.
But was he always a firebrand on the issue of immigration?
He wasn't. So for the first half of his career, the immigration issue was something he actually even said he wasn't going to waste time focusing on undocumented workers. And then what happened was in Arizona, there started to be a movement of people who were concerned about unauthorized immigration. There was an uptick of people attempting to cross the Arizona border from Mexico. And with it came a building movement to restrict and punish people who were attempting to enter the state. And so as the politics of the state shifted, state lawmakers started to pass laws to criminalize people who were smuggling people into the state, to make that a state felony. Arpaio wound up enthusiastically enforcing that law and actually applying it to migrants who were in the cars and arresting them on felony charges for attempting to smuggle themselves. And that happened in 2006, and it really is the start of his pivot towards immigration enforcement, which made him nationally known. It allowed him to raise money for his elections from national donors.
That's interesting. So as the politics intensified, his tactics intensified along with it. His legal troubles also start to mount. He was accused in those years of racial profiling. You write about this in the book. A federal judge eventually found him in contempt of court for ignoring orders to stop racial profiling. He was infamous for his workplace raids around the county. Can you just describe the types of things that the sheriff's department ended up doing that were so controversial and illegal?
Yeah, so he really began ramping up in 2007 with the help of a partnership from the federal government that he really used like no other law enforcement agency used. And so it started with rounding up day laborers, many of them who were immigrants who were looking for work. They would get picked up by sheriff's deputies and turned over to ICE for deportation. Then there were these dramatic neighborhood sweeps where his deputies would swarm neighborhoods and pull over any car for a minor traffic violation And drivers and passengers started complaining that they were being questioned and asked for ID. And what would happen is that the deputies were on the lookout for undocumented immigrants and would arrest anyone who was suspected of being undocumented in those minor traffic violations. Then there were these worksite raids, which you mentioned, which were unauthorized immigrant workers who didn't have proper documentation, who were arrested on felony charges and jailed and then turned over to ICE for deportation. So tens of thousands of immigrants wound up in ICE custody as a result of Sheriff Arpaio's policies.
Okay, and that's what started to get the attention of a group of activists in the state. And they essentially made it their mission in life to try to get rid of Arpaio, either through, you know, lawsuits or through the ballot box. What drove them? And in the early days, you know, was there a fear that their mere presence in this type of environment in the state would backfire on them?
The coalition of people who organized against Arpaio was really diverse. I mean, it involved people who were undocumented immigrants and people who were children of immigrants or who were Mexican-American with families who went back in Arizona generations. And I mean, not everyone in the movement was Latino, but we point out in the book that that it was a Latino-led effort. There were moments where people who were undocumented and at risk for deportation did come out of the shadows and join the movement to protest Arpaio, risking deportation by coming out in that way.
You know, in those days, you and I worked together at the member station KJZZ. This was when the racial profiling case was unfolding, and you were covering it, it seemed like every day at the time. And I remember that there was this sense that Arpaio, you know, much like Donald Trump, was invincible, that nothing could touch him. And I just wonder if you think that the activists felt that same way, you know, sort of secretly.
Yeah, I think that there was a lot of fear in the community about what it meant to go after him. And the people who were waging this fight for a time felt like it was a pretty lonely fight because it was hard to get people to join their coalition. Arpaio had a reputation for retaliation, something which he denies. But there's a pattern of him going after his perceived political enemies, and there were criminal investigations that were later thrown out against people who had gone up against him. And so there was a long period in Maricopa County where he was really untouchable. But I think it's also important to note that for some of the people who decided to wage this fight, they weren't at risk themselves. They were U.S. citizens, but they felt like the very principle of equality in America rested on waging this fight and bringing attention to this issue.
We do need to talk about Sheriff Arpaio's relationship with the former president, Donald Trump. Here he is introducing Trump at a campaign rally in Phoenix in 2016.
Now, Donald Trump wants to build a wall. A lot of people, you know, they're getting a little chicken these days. Well, who's going to pay for it? Okay? Now, quite frankly, I don't really care who pays for it. Let's get it built.
You know, Jude, in many ways, it feels like Arpaio was Trump before Trump was Trump, right? I mean, how much of an influence did the sheriff have on him and his policies?
One thing everyone agrees on any side of this issue, Arpaio, Arpaio's supporters, Arpaio's biggest opponents, they all agree that Arpaio is very similar to Trump. It's really undeniable. With Arpaio, he was one of the first people who endorsed Trump. And then Trump, of course, later pardoned Arpaio when he faced criminal contempt of court, guilty finding for violating court orders. Arpaio will tell you that he did not advise the president on immigration, but we do know that Arpaio showed the country how powerful of a political tool immigration enforcement could be. And I think that it's very likely that Trump took note of that potency.
The amazing thing, though, is that Arpaio lost in 2016. And that was the same year, of course, that Donald Trump swept to victory on many of those themes of immigration. So what was that like for the activists who'd fought Arpaio for so long?
many were stunned because Arpaio lost by 13 points. It was a landslide. And keep in mind, this was after 24 years in office. I mean, this was a really big deal to defeat him after so long. And yet there was also this realization that at the federal level, they now had someone who wanted to threaten their family members or their own ability to stay in the country. And so there was a lot of mixed emotions. There was an understanding that the real work was ahead of how were you going to continue this organizing for immigrant rights in this new regime. And we actually saw that some of these Arizona activists who had been practicing with these issues for so long in Arizona started advising other groups around the country.
Yeah. Well, what about the future? I mean, Arpaio is almost 90 years old now. Trump, he's out of office, but he's hinting that he's going to run for president again. Of course, immigration, totally back in the news, front and center. What do you think the next chapter in this story will be?
What we know from the Arizona lesson is that the issue of immigration can be incredibly politically powerful, and it can lead to policies that are popular, but also could risk constitutional violations, as we saw happen in Maricopa County. And they can also fuel grassroots organizing that could change the political landscape. So it'll be interesting to see how this current scenario at the border translates into our national political debate.
Jude Joffe Block's new book is Driving While Brown, Sheriff Joe Arpaio versus the Latino Resistance. She co-wrote it with journalist Terry Green Sterling. Jude, very well-reported book. It was a pleasure to connect with you again and talk about it. Congratulations.
Thank you so much, Peter. Great to talk with you.
In stressful times, you want to spend your time checking out not just what's best, but what's best for you. We know you care about what you watch, what you read, and what you listen to. NPR's Pop Culture Happy Hour podcast is with you 5 days a week to make sure that time is well spent. Listen now to the Pop Culture Happy Hour podcast from NPR.
Facebook is taking steps to remove posts that spread misinformation or mock the death of George Floyd. This comes as the nation anxiously anticipates a verdict in the trial of Derek Chauvin, the former Minneapolis police officer charged with killing Floyd. The tech giant has temporarily labeled Minneapolis a, quote, high-risk location and says it will get rid of threatening posts calling for violence. And we want to note that Facebook is a financial supporter of NPR, but we cover the company the same as we do all the others. And for more on Facebook's latest action, let's bring in Ina Fried, chief technology correspondent at Axios. Hey, Ina, welcome back.
Hi, Tanya.
What's Facebook's criteria to determine whether a post actually needs to be removed?
Well, there's actually two different thresholds, as it said. It's actually going to allow a little bit more criticism of Derek Chauvin, saying he willingly put himself into the spotlight, versus George Floyd, who it calls an involuntary public figure, that obviously the late George Floyd didn't do anything necessarily to become a public figure, but managed to become one. More importantly, though, is what it's doing around both misinformation and threats of violence. And so it's basically saying it's going to take a harder line on both of those than it normally does.
We know that there has been lots of criticism on how the company has handled issues like this in the past. Explain how it will actually regulate content specifically targeting George Floyd and Derek Chauvin.
Well, basically, you know, it's sort of how much negativity do you allow? What types of attacks do you allow in the case of each of these people? And so, you know, with the defendant, in this case, Derek Chauvin, it's going to allow criticism, but probably not threats at a certain level. Whereas for George Floyd, if there's posts, you know, mocking or doing other things that violate its harassment policy, it's going to enforce that more strictly. But it also brings up this larger issue of how Facebook deals with these issues, from misinformation to harassment and threats of violence every day. Kevin Roos of the New York Times put it well. He called it an airplane black box situations, referring to the old saying that if you can make a black box that survives an airplane crash, why don't you build the airplane out of the whole airplane out of whatever you use to build the back box? And I think while that isn't practical for airplanes, it is somewhat practical for Facebook. And I do think there will be pressure on them to do that.
Just clarification, is Facebook only monitoring content published just outside or in Minneapolis, or does it apply to users across the world regarding this case with Derek Chauvin?
I think with regards to posts directed at them, it may apply more broadly, but specifically when it comes to violence and Facebook groups and the potential for real-world violence. Right now, it's focused on Minneapolis, but the company did say that it's watching things closely and may expand that geographic region. Obviously, this verdict is being watched around the country and around the world, and there's a potential for violence not just in Minneapolis, but elsewhere.
Okay, this is Facebook, but what about some of those other platforms like Twitter or Reddit?
I think we may hear from those other platforms, also Google with YouTube. I think everyone's keeping a close eye on this and figuring out what they need to do in terms of twisting those dials and knobs in terms of what speech gets allowed and what gets limited.
Ina Fried is the chief technology correspondent for Axios. As always, thank you so much, Ina.
Thanks, Tanya.
Indigenous Americans are almost four times more likely to contract COVID-19 and twice as likely to die from it as white people. This disparity did not come as a surprise for Abigail Echo Hawk, a public health researcher for the Seattle Indian Health Board and a member of the Pawnee Nation of Oklahoma. When her workplace requested more PPE last year, they got a box of body bags instead, leaving Abigail feeling like the U.S. government didn't value the lives of Native Americans. With no use for those body bags, the facility actually calls an ambulance if someone dies there, Abigail decided to transform one into a traditional Native ribbon dress. It's since been featured in Vogue magazine and will appear in the Indigenous Film and Arts Festival in Colorado later this year. Abigail Echo Hawk joins us now. Welcome to Here and Now.
Thanks for having me.
Thank you for being here. For listeners who don't know, what is a traditional Native ribbon dress and how did you learn to make them?
This is a kind of regalia that we wore prior to colonization and also now wear in traditional ceremonies, in powwows. I wear them at home. It's just a type of dress that many of our Native women wear across different kinds of tribes. And I was really blessed to have learned how to make ribbon dresses from my aunties. My auntie Linnea John taught me to sew for the very first time when I was about 8 years old. And I've always loved making regalia for my family and for my community.
Mm-hmm. So you got these body bags after you asked specifically for PPE. How did the idea of turning a body bag into this kind of transformation come about?
When we received those body bags, it was quite devastating. I remember in opening them up, and the first thing that happened is I kind of tilted the bag is toe tags fell out on the table. And I immediately had tears in my eyes. I remember driving home after that day, crying all the way from my office back to where I live. And it was really traumatizing. And one of the things that I've learned is that if I don't deal with the trauma that I experience every single day as a public health researcher, and also as somebody who works in a clinic that is serving Native people, that in order for me to serve my community well, I have to be in a good place. So when I got these body bags and was given the opportunity to take some home, you know, I thought, what can I do with this to repurpose it, to help bring healing to myself, and for me to think about these body bags in a different way? I refuse to accept that the federal government only will give us body bags. I am going to push them to ensure that they give us the resources that we need so our communities just don't survive, but they thrive.
Did officials explain to you what happened, why you all even got body bags instead of PPE in the first place? Was it a mistake?
We actually had the company itself reached out and let us know that they were sorry after they saw the news story about how impactful this was to our community. And when they reached out, they let us know they couldn't tell us who had sent them, but they just wanted to apologize that it caused such harm to us. So we really appreciated that. But to this day, we don't know where those body bags came from.
Hmm. Well, let's talk about the dress. I mean, there are some really amazing aspects of this dress and how you designed it. It's embellished with mirrors and red handprints and writings. Were you surprised at all at the outpour you've received from it? You have this piece in Vogue. It will appear in the Indigenous Film and Arts Festival in Colorado. This really resonated with people.
I was really surprised. And something that was meant originally for my own healing, which is what I use art for, I was surprised to see how much it actually was part of healing for our community, the Native community, and how it raised awareness to those who did not know the things that my community is facing.
You are a public health researcher. We are in the thick of COVID-19. Tell us a bit about how things are going in the Seattle area and the effort to try to curb the virus, specifically among Native American tribes.
We continue to face a disproportionate impact of COVID-19 within the Native community here in Seattle, Washington, and nationwide. We know that Native people right now have higher rates of hospitalization and the highest rates of death of any racial or ethnic group in this country, and it is absolutely devastating. I've lost family members, I've lost friends, and I am not alone in that. We are fighting every single day, and we have nonprofits like the Seattle Indian Health Board, where I work, along with our tribal partners, who are working to stop the spread of this virus within our communities. And we have seen some incredible wins. Here in Washington State, the tribal communities and the urban Indian organizations like the Seattle Indian Health Board have some of the highest vaccination rates of American Indians and Alaska Natives. And we've also worked to vaccinate members of the larger community. Seattle Indian Health Board vaccinated Seattle public school teachers before the state of Washington did. And so I've seen the strengths of our community and taking care of everybody around us. But I know that the impact of this pandemic has not ended. And in fact, the data is showing us that this disproportionate impact is still happening.
Abigail, thank you so much for the work that you do and for sharing a bit more about this Native ribbon dress with us.
Thank you so much.
Abigail Echo Hawk of the Seattle Indian Health Board talking with us about the Native ribbon dress she made out of a body bag to symbolize resilience during this pandemic.
All right, let's go deeper into this issue now, because tribes that are not officially recognized by the U.S. government won't be getting any federal help that had been earmarked for Indian Country. Eilish O'Neill of member station KUOW introduces us to one of those tribes in this report that first aired on All Things Considered.
The Chinook Indian Nation has about 3,000 members who mostly live near the mouth of the Columbia River. But they're not on the list of federally recognized tribes, so they get nothing from the Indian Health Service.
We have all the problems of Indian Country, but no means of dealing with it.
Chinook Chair Tony Johnson says without recognition, they get no reservation, no housing allowance, no clinics. And during the pandemic, it's meant no testing supplies or vaccine allocations.
So we rely on our neighboring tribes, which means that people are traveling an hour or two or three to be able to access vaccinations, testing, and other resources.
The nearby Shoalwater Bay tribe, for example, gave Johnson his COVID vaccine. He says unemployment spiked in Southwest Washington during the pandemic, and with it, addiction problems. But the Chinook received no federal funds for drug and alcohol programs. Johnson says no local tribal members have died of COVID, but several have died because of COVID, not only of addiction, but of untreated chronic conditions like diabetes.
We have lost folks in the community over the last year that would not have been lost were Chinook to have been a federally recognized community, and that is unbearable.
Many tribes are federally recognized because at some point they signed a treaty agreeing to give up their land. For complicated reasons, the Chinook Nation isn't recognized, even though they did at one point sign a treaty.
It was an accident of history that left some off the list and included others.
John Norwood of the National Congress of American Indians works on federal recognition issues. He says gaining federal recognition now can be nearly impossible, regardless of a tribe's history. On paper, it's one thing.
The regulations as they stood appeared to be just fine.
But how they're used is a different story.
The problem was their interpretation and application became more stringent, less transparent, very inconsistent, oftentimes punitive.
Another Western Washington tribe the U.S. government refuses to recognize is the Snohomish. They're the namesake of the county north of Seattle.
We'll continue to be here as long as the mountains still exist and the rivers run through the forest out into the sea.
The Snohomish tribe's chair, Mike Evans, says today the tribe has about 1,500 enrolled members, but
we don't have a clinic, we don't have the vaccines to distribute, and there's no money to deal with that.
And without federal recognition, there won't be any money in the future either. The most recent COVID relief package included more than $31 billion for the tribes on the federal government's list, adding to funds earmarked in the prior two relief bills. Tony Johnson, chair of the Chinook Nation, says tribes used those funds for unemployment relief, food programs, and infrastructure projects.
The once-in-a-lifetime, once-in-a-generation infusions of funds will be having impact on those communities generations to come.
He says it's heartbreaking that his own Chinook Indian Nation won't have access to any of those resources. For NPR News, I'm Alicia O'Neill in Southwest Washington.
A gigantic glacier in Antarctica is melting faster than scientists previously thought, according to new research published this month. For the first time ever, researchers sent an unmanned submarine underneath the Thwaites Glacier, and it found warm currents of ocean water lapping away at the ice. That's concerning news because the Thwaites contains enough fresh water to significantly raise global sea levels if it collapses. The research was published this month in the journal Science Advances, and Rob Larder was one of the co-authors. He's with the British Antarctic Survey, and he joins us now on Skype. Rob, welcome. Most of us will never have the chance to see this very, very remote glacier in person. So describe it for us. How big is it? How quickly is it melting?
The entire glacier is about the size of Florida. So many of your audience, many people have probably seen a glacier somewhere in the Rockies, perhaps. They think of a little valley glacier. This is a totally different order of magnitude. This is a glacier that is the size of a medium-sized country. And where it meets the sea, the front of the glacier is about 100-kilometer length of ice front. And over the last 30 years, it's become progressively more and more out of balance, losing a lot more than it receives.
So this is a massive glacier. Most of it is on land, but it feeds into the sea, and we're losing a fair amount of it. When you sent that submarine underneath the ice, what did you find?
I mean, it's a fantastic piece of technology, very sophisticated software and programming that you can set this submersible up with a mission, and it'll go exactly where you tell it, and it knows how to avoid obstacles. And it's got a lot of sensors. So it's measuring the temperature of the water, the conductivity, the oxygen content. And a surprising thing from the characteristics we know of the water masses around Thwaites Glacier, we could see that some of the water we were seeing at the western front has come all the way from the eastern side. We now know one of the major flows of water going under the floating extension of the glacier.
So why is that significant?
Many places where a glacier comes down to the sea in Antarctica, it flows out over the water. It doesn't just stop at that point in a cliff. And you form these things called ice shelves, which are glacier ice that's come off the continent. And for a large part of this ice shelf, the water we need to be concerned about is coming from that eastern side. And we had thought that didn't go particularly far underneath before.
And if there's warm water getting underneath there, then that could melt the ice, and the glacier would be in danger, perhaps of breaking off and going into the sea. How much of a danger is that right now?
Well, eventually it'll either become thin enough that the front of it will float off, or it may just become thin in the middle and break out. And when that does happen, we have every reason to expect that the ice will flow more quickly from upstream. So ice that's currently above sea level will go into the ocean, and that's what really raises sea level.
I'm glad you mentioned that because, you know, we hear a lot of stories in the news about melting glaciers, about cracking ice sheets. I think it can be hard for people to triage all of this information and to sort of put it into context and to understand what it means. So how concerned should we be about the findings here in this study?
The thing is, if you look around the world, there are about 1 billion people who live within 10 meters of high tide lines. So as sea level rises, the frequency of flooding events due to surges becomes much more frequent. You know, in the UK, it's a constant concern for areas of central London, and we have the Thames Barrier, which at the moment, we think is good till the latter part of this century with the way sea level rise is going. But the similar problems with across the water at the port in Rotterdam and you know, similar problems in New York. Well, in all these places, people who are planning the infrastructure for the future and indeed the sustainability of some parts of these cities want to know, what are we looking at in 2100? Are we looking at sea level 30 centimeters higher than now? Are we looking at sea level maybe a meter higher than now or even more?
Hmm. So at this point then, is there anything that can be done for the Thwaites Glacier or is it already too late?
I don't think anything that humankind does is going to reverse what's happening. I mean, sea level has been rising for many decades. It's accelerated through the 20th century from a couple of millimeters a year to getting on for 4 millimeters a year now. And that trend's probably going to carry on for a while. But we're not going to turn sea level rise around anytime soon. Hmm. It really is important to know how much there is going to be.
Rob Larder, a marine geophysicist with the British Antarctic Survey, talking about the Thwaites Glacier. Thank you very much. I appreciate it.
Thank you for your time.
Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Peter O'Dowd.
And I'm Tanya Mosley. This is Here and Now.